This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
We're here with Linda Valdez. Linda, as you probably know, is a columnist for the Arizona Republic. What you may not know is that she is the author of a new book, Crossing the Line, A Marriage Across Borders. This is an autobiographical treatment of her marriage to a once undocumented immigrant from Mexico. I want to tell you, I read an electronic copy of this book that did not have a cover on it. And so I started reading it, and it took me several chapters before I realized that it wasn't a novel. And by the way, that it was just that well written and that engrossing. This is a real bicultural experience on both sides of the border that provide us with really a rich source of insight into two cultures. And that's reflected in what I found to be a absolutely fascinating read. Welcome to the Think Tank.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
It may surprise people to know that you're actually an Anglo from the Midwest, I believe, right?
Yes, I was born in Ohio. Yes, there are many of my readers suggest I go back where I came from.
Go back where you came from.
And they don't mean Ohio.
They don't mean Ohio.
Ohio was my second guess, though. You know.
I read your book. Fundamentally, as a tribute to two people, primarily, your husband and your mother-in-law.
You could say that.
That was my takeaway. It just reflected incredible admiration for both.
I have incredible admiration for both. I feel a little guilty because I would think my own mother should be included in there because she does play a role in the book. And I had certainly as much admiration for her as for either of the others. But I can understand your takeaway.
I didn't sense anything negative about your own mother, but in the story, she was more of a supporting player than a primary player.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, tell us, you met your husband, and how did that happen, and how did you develop a relationship?
I met my husband on a trip with my mother to Copper Canyon. I had been planning to do something else with someone else, and that fell through, and she talked me into taking this trip to Mexico with her. And at this point, I'll be honest, I was no big fan of Mexico, and I really wasn't looking forward to this trip. I left all my makeup at home and said, you know, okay, I'm just going to hang out and do what I do. And I'm the course of that trip, I met Sixto, who became my husband. He was working in one of the hotels in Copper Canyon. He was training to be a manager there. And he fell and hurt his ankle. So he rode the train back with us, the famous Copper Canyon train. And I sat next to him and we got to know each other. The train stopped in Siracawi, which is called, Siracawi is for lovers, is what they say. It's a place for lovers. We stayed the night there, our group did. And I got to know him more in a dinner there. And then we took the train the rest of the way to Los Mochis. And by that time, I was pretty much in love with him. I mean, it was truly a story of love at first sight. I came back to Tucson and he stayed there. And that was supposedly the end of it.
Well, he stayed there in Mexico.
He stayed in Mexico.
The part about that I didn't understand. It's my understanding you did not speak Spanish.
No.
Did not speak English.
Well, he spoke a little Spanish, a little English, and I spoke high school and college Spanish. Mm-hmm. I had my obligatory 4 semesters, mm-hmm. so I could we spoke a little bit. Yes, mm-hmm. We managed to get by. We were not speaking, I don't think, a language. I think what we were speaking went beyond your normal language. I guess one might say. Truly, we were falling in love. Mm-hmm. It's a love story.
Yeah. I got that. I'm just, I couldn't get how you could get past the language of nuance.
You'd be surprised how you can get past the language when you're sitting next to someone on a train going through some of the most beautiful country in the world.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law, her name was Doña Soledad Leyva, and she was 14 when she got married. She had 14 children, raised all of them to adulthood in a home with dirt floors. She was absolutely dedicated to her husband, who died when my husband was about 16 or 18, somewhere right in there. She was just an amazing woman. She embraced me from the moment I first saw her and accepted me with all my strange little gringa ways, you know, my hair dryer and my tea and, you know, all the things that I brought with me. She embraced me and accepted me, and I loved her. I loved her dearly.
She comes across as a very matriarch, a very dominant kind of figure in the book.
Well, she was dominant, yes, but not domineering in any sense. She was dominant through her, her will, her compassion, her love, in that sense. But yes, she never entered a room. When she entered a room, that was it. She was there. She was definitely there.
There's one phrase, and we can complete this. We may run out of time here, but that just stuck in my mind when you made reference to your mom and your mother-in-law, and you said neither would change places with the other.
No, I don't think either one of them would. But also, I think they were very much, they were very similar. They were very similar characters and very similar in their approach to their children and their lives. But I don't know. Neither one of them would have traded places with the other.
And I think that what that got to me about that was there's sort of an America, very ethnocentric American assumption. Of course, everybody would rather be here and everybody in the world would be rather be in America. It's not true.
No, it's not true. And I think that's one of the things I'm glad that came through in the book, because I think that's important for people to understand.
So we've gone through really a tough period in our border relations with Mexico. Do you see that subsiding, or you think things are getting worse?
It's changing. I don't think it's necessarily getting better, but it's changing. The new immigrants are coming from Central America now, the undocumented immigrants, more than from Mexico. I think that's going to continue to be a trend, because the birth rate in Mexico has gone down and their economic situation has improved to some degree. I think the attitude towards the people who are coming across the border, I do not think has improved. And I think the fault lies to a great extent with our so-called political leaders, who are just demagoguing this issue and continue to do so. The focus now has gotten a little bit more onto Muslims and other types of people. But they'll get back to the border again.
But remember, there's no win in a solution. There's only a win in a crisis politically. So that's where the money in the coffers come from, is the crisis, not the solution. So
that's true.
We're going to stay with Linda Valdez right here on The Think Tank, coming up next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here with Linda Valdez, columnist for the Arizona Republic and author of a recently published book, Crossing the Line, A Marriage Across Borders. There's one moment in the book that I have a just visual image of, and you're standing on a kind of a hilltop or mountaintop surrounded by a flood.
Yes.
Tell us the story. How did that happen?
The flood was quite amazing. We decided that my mother, my sister, her son, and of course my husband and I would all go down and visit my mother-in-law over Christmas break, and then we were going to stay there a couple days
and we're talking very, very rural town, right?
Yes, very, very rural. Yes, it's a very rural community outside of Los Mochis. Yes, very rural, very small. And we were going to stay there a couple days, then we were going to take the train into Copper Canyon. Well, the first night that we were there, we got a warning to evacuate. The whole community came alive, which doesn't usually happen there. What had happened was upstream, they released water from the dam. It wasn't raining where we were, but they released water from the dam. The river was overflowing, and there was a huge irrigation canal right across the road from my mother-in-law's house, and it was beginning to overflow. So we all were told we were going to evacuate to this little hill that was in the middle of some fields behind my mother-in-law's house, which we did. We loaded up the truck. We got as many. I mean, she took the stove and the butane tank. You know, it's like my mother at one point looked at me and said, "How long are we going to be up there?" We had no idea how long we were going to be up there. We all, then basically the whole community went and set up camp. They brought their chickens, they brought their pigs, and we stayed there for several days. We celebrated New Year's Eve of 1991 on the hill, and I was about 4 months pregnant at that time.
I want to read from a little excerpt from the book, and it's a long paragraph, but I thought it's worth a read about your experience there. Those who made us part of their world on that hill were not all relatives. They were not all people whose nationality and ethnic identity, they were all people whose nationality and ethnic identity are routinely decried as a threat to culture, economy, and social structure of the United States. They were all poor people whose poverty also made them instantly suspect of being unable to offer anything of value to anybody else. But their ingenuity and generosity kept us fed and safe. And then you continue. They didn't stop to ask us if we deserved their help. They didn't think about whether we'd earned it or whether we were worthy to receive it. Nobody asked if our visas were in order. They embraced us, fed us, wished us Happy New Year. And then you go on to speculate. You wonder if the circumstances were reversed.
I would hope that if the circumstances were reversed, that this community or any other in this country would do the same. But evidence would suggest that it hasn't. And the example that comes to my mind is the Central American children that were coming here and are beginning to come here again. And as refugees, they are looking for help. They're looking for a safe place. And we basically treated them like vermin and continue to treat them as a huge problem. So I don't know if it would, if the tables were turned. I think it's easier on an individual basis to help a person that's sitting across from you.
Yeah.
But as a culture, as a society, as a country, we do not embrace the people that come to us for help.
So if we're going to truly turn the tables, though, and I want to stay on that real quick, and you have a better insight to this than any of us. If it were U.S. immigrants going to Mexico and flooding into Mexico, how would that be? Because you mentioned the South American immigrants coming here. What about us going there? Those tables turned.
What would we be going there for?
Whatever it is. Whatever it is. I don't know, escaping something. Escaping some tyrannic Trump organization or something like that. You know,
okay.
Whatever it is.
Massive waterboarding.
Whatever it is. Whatever it is, yes.
Okay, so we're going there for out of fear and
yes,
in
fear
need
of
help.
Correct.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I think a lot would depend, how we were received might depend on how we were portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
If we were portrayed as these terrible invaders who are out to undermine the culture and the language, we might not be received very well.
But how do they view us?
I was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I was accepted, my family, my mother, my sister, my nephew, when we were down there. None of them spoke Spanish, not even the pidgin Spanish that I spoke. And they were embraced. They were accepted. Now, that may have to do largely because we were part of Doña Soli's family. I'm sure that had something to do with it. But we were accepted at every visit after that. People would ask me, neighbors would say, how's your mother? How's your sister? How's your nephew? You know, I mean, we were people and we were accepted at that level. And I have a feeling that that would basically be the reception.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree. I would agree. In my trips down there in my youth with my grandparents over and over and over again, it was the same thing. It was welcome with open arms and everybody just grab some food and let's hang out. I think it's just the way it always was.
Well, I think we have another view of that, though, which is they're not terribly accepting of folks who are coming from their south, the Central Americans.
That's an interesting situation. Now, and the United States has some culpability for that because we put big pressure on them to stop the flow at the southern border.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. And maybe that's more of an analogous situation because those
people
are people
coming from an economy and situation that's even worse.
Exactly.
I mean, Americans that go to Mexico have money.
Exactly.
So,
and it's hard to get around that. It's hard to get around that image. That's an interesting situation. And I don't know how much of that is a result of U.S. pressure to stop that immigration and how much of it. I mean, let's face it. Mexico's police and their institutions tend to be pretty corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the abuse that goes on with those migrants coming across the southern border is from those corrupt organizations. Mm-hmm. There is a national organization, a national human rights organization in Mexico that works to try and protect the refugees and the people coming across the border. But, you know, it's they face a lot of pain and abuse coming up from the south. There's no question about that.
But I think that's one area where our perception has lagged the reality, that if we're talking about people coming across our southern border right now, they're probably not Mexicans.
Exactly.
They're probably Central Americans.
Increasingly, they are Central Americans.
And therefore, in many cases, fleeing not just poverty, but situations where their lives are in peril.
There's great violence. Yes, great violence and a lot of gang activity in some of the Central American countries, Salvador, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. Those places are in great turmoil. People, the kids that were coming here that summer, who are still coming here, they were fleeing really bad situations where they were either being pressed into gangs, being threatened. They're coming from a bad situation.
And our laws are quite different. If you're fleeing actual persecution, that's a legitimate basis for immigration. Fleeing economic deprivation is not.
Well, I think if you're fleeing political persecution, but if you're fleeing persecution from the gang down the street, then that's not considered a legitimate reason.
A unique perspective on our U.S. and Mexico relations as it relates to immigration from Linda Valdez. More here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with the Arizona Republic's Linda Valdez. You had a blurb in the paper the other day. You'd like to replace the words alien and illegal alien with, and I quote, foreign national or undocumented foreign national. Why?
Well, this is a bill in Congress, and I was speaking in support of it, and I got some very interesting response from this. Oh, my goodness. I got a lot of anger, vehemence. I was told that Mexicans were maggots, and it doesn't matter what we call them. I mean, ugly, very ugly stuff.
Wow.
I think that it's a charged word. The use of illegal immigrant, or particularly illegal alien, has been used to denigrate people and dehumanize them. And so a country that is supposed to respect human rights and dignity should recognize that and proceed to change that in its statutes. I mean, this doesn't say, you know, rip everything up and spend millions of dollars. It's just change it as you go. And I think I have done my best to eliminate those words from my vocabulary, even though I could make the argument that they are factual. Mm-hmm. One who crosses the border illegally is an illegal immigrant. And at one point, I was going to call my book, I Married an Illegal Immigrant. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, that's kind of pejorative. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. It has become pejorative. Yeah.
And I think it's also politically very potent in that we are a country of laws. And it is widespread American culture that we should, in general, obey the laws that we've all agreed to. And so if the first word you hear about something or somebody is that they're illegal, reasonable people will say, well, that's wrong.
That's true. You know? That's true.
And it's before you know the person, before you know the circumstance, if it's the very first label. I mean, the power of labels. I had a newspaper article here the other day that I had talked about it was an old clipping, okay? Freedom fighter, you know, we're fighting in the Afghanistan. He's working to get out the right. The freedom fighter in question was, and there was a big old picture of him, Osama bin Laden. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the power. This is a freedom fighter because he's opposing the Russians. So labels have this incredible potency, and I think very often what they do is we never get to, you know, conversely, the word terrorist, which is the first thing that any government will try to do with an opposition that they want to neutralize. If you can get your opposition characterized as a terrorist organization, you kind of win the political debate.
Absolutely. If you can dehumanize your opposition, then you have a big advantage.
Label them with something that people instinctively despise.
Yes.
And we're all against terrorists, right? But the point being, there are cases where one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Or depending on the decade that you're looking at this person, yes.
Well, and also, I mean, terrorism is the tool of the disenfranchised. You know, I mean, the leaders of the founding of the State of Israel were all branded terrorists by the British for a period of time.
Well, probably those fighting the Revolutionary War in the United States America were probably branded some similar word from those days.
And if we'd lost, they'd probably still have that label.
They might, yeah. But you don't want to go too far to legitimize terrorism to make it sound like it's ever justified.
That's not to say that there aren't people who are terrorists. Right. I'm saying that, though, at the margin, if you're running a repressive regime and somebody opposes you, I'm saying that politically the first thing you want to do is label those folks a terrorist.
Absolutely.
Not that there aren't real terrorists who totally deserve the term.
I'm not going to equate the two, obviously, immigration and terrorism, but I'm going to say that from the other side, when you deal with this subject specifically, going from illegal alien to illegal immigrant to undocumented worker, undocumented nationalist, what are we saying here? Undocumented, which one? Anyway, undocumented anything. Well, that's just from the other side.
See, so that tells you how powerful. Tells you how powerful those phrases are. You remembered illegal alien, you didn't remember the other thing.
Well, right? I've been ingrained in illegal alien
exactly,
since I was
yes.
a child.
It comes off the lips very easily and not necessarily with any animus.
So, but it does have the word illegal. Yeah. Linda, like you said, if you're going to call it what it is, okay, they're coming here illegally. So illegal, that's in there. From the other side, when you look at this transition in linguistics, what you see is, we're softening it. We're taking illegal out of this. We're justifying it. We're marginalizing it. We're making it okay is what we're doing. That's from the other side. I was interested in what you think about that.
Okay. We're justifying it. Well, our policies, our national policies justify it because once you get across the border, you find a job and you work here. I mean, so we, as a country, we justify it. We essentially invite them to come here and work because they're good for the economy. If there was a provision in the 1986 immigration law for worksite enforcement, if we had really wanted to stop illegal immigration, that would have been enforced. And it wasn't, because it wasn't acceptable to business and it wasn't acceptable to the human rights folks. And it was tried and it failed. And that's why, so as a national policy, we justify illegal immigration. All we do is we build these barriers, we make it difficult and deadly for people to come here. And then once you get here, oh, sure, here's this job for you. And we'll basically let you live in the shadows, 11, 12 million of you, because you're good for our economy.
I was just more speaking of the just this change in the phrase and the people that don't want the phrase to be changed.
Well,
I'm hiding under the desk.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, the other argument is that a person cannot be illegal. I mean, you could say an immigrant who crossed the border illegally or a migrant who crossed the border illegally. But when you dismiss someone as illegal, as you know, as Mike pointed out, that is just immediately reduces their humanity. You don't see that person.
You
know,
we do that when somebody's convicted of a crime. We say convicted felon Mike O'Neill. Convicted.
That's true.
You see, what I'm saying we do that anyway. We did.
Well,
that's not exclusive to an immigrant.
That has some very bad consequences too.
Sure.
In that we talk about recidivism rates and somebody trying to work their way out of that. If you are labeled as a convict, try to get a job.
Convicts are guilty of something far more egregious than crossing the border illegally.
But I'll tell you, in another country, the invidious way, you know who has been, and they've changed this only within a matter of days? The Chinese, if you are a second-born child, you are an illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Because according to the Chinese laws, you're permitted one child.
Well, they're struggling with that now,
The second child themselves, essentially, they are undocumented. They don't get paperwork. They can't go to school. There's all sorts of bad things that That's the mechanism that they use to enforce the one-child policy is all sorts of legal government benefits that you would otherwise everybody else would be entitled to. The second children have not been. That's an interesting parallel.
It is a real big problem for China. They're going to have to deal with that.
Well, they've actually come around. In the last several days, they've been revising that policy. You know, as they've revised the
right, they're providing the second, paperwork yeah, for those yeah. folks, but yeah,
that's also the way they keep people out of the cities. You know, it is illegal immigration if you move from the countryside to the cities without permission, because it's against the law. And the reason it's against the law is that they've got about a billion people in the countryside living in a 14th century existence, and they all went into the 20th or 21st century in the cities. And the national government is trying to build quick enough to do it, but you can't move a billion people overnight, and so they make it illegal.
Linda, can you tell us about the book one more time? Give us the title and where we can find that, please. And it's not I Married an Illegal Alien.
No, it's not.
That was a working title.
It's called Crossing the Line, A Marriage Across Borders. And it's published by Texas Christian University. And you can get it on Amazon. You just type in my name and the name of the book. You could get it through Texas A&M Consortium, which is TAMUPress.com, and it's also around various bookstores. So, but you can look for it there, or ask for it at your bookstore.
Check that. Yes, do that. I like that even better.
Get them to order it.
That's right.
To order it. Thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it. It's an amazing story, and wish you luck with the book and continued success with the Arizona Republic as well. Doc and I are going to tie a bow around this one when we come back on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I'm telling you, it's a great book, but I'm telling you, it would have sold better had it been titled I Married an Illegal Immigrant, like her working title. I mean, that's an eye catcher right there.
It probably was, yeah. And I read the book, and it was a great story.
Sure, okay, it is.
I got interested. It was a little Steinbeck-esque. I got interested in the characters.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they are interesting characters.
They're real folks. Her mother-in-law, in particular, is this sort of dominant. Yeah, not domineering, but dominant. She's a sort of central character. You see this whole extended family that she's kind of held together.
Right. We got into some serious issues, and obviously the central issue is immigration and what we view as an illegal alien or undocumented nationalist, whatever we're going to call
them. She has a cross-cultural marriage. By the way, the other part of the story is that we didn't really get into was in order to – he arrives on her doorstep after this, having crossed through what was then a more porous border than now.
Mm-hmm.
And they develop a relationship, and then they go about getting legal.
Yeah.
So he has to go back to Mexico and go through papers and all that and get basically as a result of fiancé status.
I think with the discussion we talked about, though, the discussion we brought up with Linda was especially when I asked if you start to not call them illegal aliens, mm-hmm. it kind of justifies what they're doing. She brought up a good point, and she was very energetic about it, and I appreciate that about her. But I will say that, boy, let me try to phrase this right. She was backing what I've always thought for a long time. I'll say is that it's not the immigrants, it's the immigration system. If you have a problem with immigrants coming across our border, look here first. At why they are, why they can, why they have succeeded, and why they will continue to. It's our own immigration system. That's what it is. It's broken.
We have been very ambivalent about it. There are those in, for example, the labor movement that want to close the borders because they think they're bringing cheap labor in.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of business people who are very much open borders because it brings in a labor force.
Cheap labor.
And we had,
it what it is.
You know, some time back we had Jack August here and we talked about that. And he said, basically, the housing industry is screaming that they need people with certain skills, and they're not available here.
Sure.
So we have these two. So we have these laws that basically forbid immigration from the South, for all intents and purposes, forbidding it. I mean, the waiting laws, waiting line, that illusory line is 130 years long. It's not good, other than spouses or things like
that. Hold on. I have a sister-in-law who is South African.
Okay.
She's married my brother-in-law. They have two children.
Mm-hmm.
She's still not a citizen. She's been here, I think, 13 years, 12 years?
Actually, what most people want more than citizenship is they want entree. She is in this country, right?
Sure.
If you think about it, really what people want is legal immigration status, because that is life-changing, right? And then
agreed.
Citizenship, once you're already here and your children are citizens, you would like it, but it's not a life-or-death pressing kind of matter.
No, understood. Yeah. I'm using that as an illustration of, and she's from South Africa, but it's how almost impossible it is to darn near do this the right way.
The point I'm making is that we are very ambivalent. We create laws that make it difficult, and then we have policies that make us want to look the other way, and that it's always been a function of loose versus tight labor markets. When the economy goes sour and people lose their jobs, then the cries to seal the border go up.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have employment shortages, and particularly employment shortages in selected skills, construction trades being a prime example, then the business community puts pressure on the government not to enforce those laws that are on the books.
Sure. And it makes sense.
It's like we can't make up our mind what we want.
Right, but there has to be. And when we go to the overall overriding theme of immigration, there has to be I think at some point we have to stop trying to play nice. And if you do need to shut something down, it should be able to be shut down. We have to, if nothing else, protect our country. And if something happens that we need to shut something down, we should have to stop worrying about a small minority that starts screaming and hollering about it. But the problem is it's never, never electorally politically advantageous to do so.
Well, the political advantage is often to hypocrisy. You publicly say close the borders, but then you don't do those things that are actually necessary. If you wanted to really seriously impede that, you'd do it through employment. You'd enforce employer sanctions, and you'd say, listen, you know, you need in order to work, you need to be validated, legal, and if you don't. We're going to come down on the companies for
that. Then why isn't that being thrown around versus build a wall?
Well,
because that seems like it would make sense. Does anyone really want a solution?
I think build the wall sounds plausible until you, if you really see yourself being besieged, you think that a wall will do it. But, this Janet DePaula once said this, show me a 12-foot wall, I'll show you a 14-foot ladder.
Right.
A physical wall isn't, essentially, even if you're doing a wall, it wouldn't be a physical wall. It would be electronic. It would be surveillance. It would be, I think, mostly employment. By the way, and that wall would do nothing. 40% of the people who are here outside of the law are here because they overstayed perfectly legitimate visas.
Sure.
In other words, they got in here legally, and you get a six-month visa or whatever, and on the seventh month, you're now illegal. 40% is that.
Right.
So, and they flew in on airplanes. So a wall is going to do absolutely zero for that. If you wanted to take those numbers way down, you would do it through employment. You would make it so difficult to employ people outside of validated status that nobody would want to do it.
And here's the problem. We have organized labor that aren't and haven't been very big fans of immigration.
Labor's against.
Because
if you want higher wages for your members, you want fewer people to be able to work. And if companies can't get enough workers, that ain't the labor that, that'll raise the wages payable to union members. And so, whether it's a shortage, that's the company's problem.
Union members, union groups, union organizations, unions usually contribute to a DNR. a D. So which it is politically, it's political suicide for a Democrat to be anti-immigration. So there's a big crux that we, once again, another roadblock we see to actually getting something done.
Well, I think there's some bifurcation. I mean, if you said the unions don't want immigration, they want to be anti-immigration.
Yes.
Okay. So, that side of the Democratic Party would like to see more stringent anti-immigration.
Is there an anti-immigration wing to the Democrat Party? I have not seen it.
Well, it's the labor movement.
Okay. Well,
it's the labor movement.
Okay. So the labor movement is the one that puts every D into office.
Then you go into the Hispanic community. I think here's where I think it gets bifurcated is that many, many of those families are blended. They're people who are citizens, lots of them. Mm-hmm. But they got some cousin who's here without papers and they don't want their cousin thrown out. But they, on the other hand, might not. They're not necessarily in favor of open borders either because they're competing with those folks for jobs.
Yep.
So what they don't like to see is across the board ethnic sweeps, Sheriff Joe type variety where you're sweeping the streets of Hispanics or making life unpleasant for all Hispanics here because some of them might not be documented. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean they're open borders either.
You want to know what I think is most divisive of all in that vein, exactly what you just said right there, is the we don't break up families. It's not an American thing to do. We don't break up families. I think that divides the issue more than anything because the anti-immigration crowd is going, so? Well, who cares? Broke the law, period, done.
Yep.
And the other side is, so we love families, so let them come in and bring more family. Oh, come on.
And that's a lot of the cases. You know,
it's divisive.
Your kid's born here, they're a citizen, but mom and dad may not be. Or maybe dad is and mom isn't. You know, it's a mixture of every combination known to man.
It is.
And like all of our persistent problems, if it had an easy solution, we would have already done it.
And there's no real win in a solution politically. Only win in crisis.
Yeah.
My man Rahm Emanuel pointed that one out. He's in some hot water.
He is. That's a whole other show.
We should invite Rahm onto the show. He seems like such a nice guy. He used to be a dancer. Did you know that? He used to be a ballet guy.
Send you a dead fish.
Yeah. I remember that. Holy cow. On behalf of KTR News staff, Doc O'Neill, Mike Russell, right here in the Think Tank.